supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
Welcome to another exciting episode of You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I am your host, Mike McGrath, and we got another of those jam-packed shows for you today, Cats and Kittens. In the question of the week, we will discuss moving plants across international borders and what that entails. We'll also welcome back our old friend, Dr. Lee Reich, the peerless pruner and fruit tree expert who has a new book out about being curious in his garden. That's a lot of curious stuff to get to, so we better get right to your fascinating phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Barbara, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi, Mike. Thanks for taking my call.
Well, thank you for making it, Barbara. Where are you?
In Pittsgrove, New Jersey.
And where's Pittsgrove exactly?
In southern New Jersey. It's about 45 minutes south of Philadelphia.
What can we do for Barbara in the Garden State?
My dad had a fig tree. He passed away in February, and my family's trying very much to keep the fig tree alive.
Mm-hmm.
And for some reason this year, I don't know if it was the cold winter, what we're seeing right now is that the tree looks mostly dead. And yet, even though it looks dead and it seems brittle, there's all of this green coming up from the bottom of the ground.
Okay.
So about 3 feet high of the 8 foot measurement of the tree is all of these beautiful fig
mm-hmm.
leaves.
Uh-huh.
And then what appears to be a dead tree. And
okay,
we're not
okay.
sure what to do about it.
Okay. Let me first reassure you that the tree itself is very much alive.
Oh,
there,
great.
There is no long-term problem here. Now, do you not remember him doing something to prepare the fig for winter?
Oh, I do know that it was pruned back each year and wrapped in, I think it was actually like contractor bags.
Mm-hmm.
Some straw was put around it, and then it was wrapped to keep it protected from the wind and the cold.
And did anybody do anything with it last fall?
Yes, same thing happened. Pruned back, wrapped up, some straw, and I believe wrapped up in some real heavy plastic sheeting.
Okay, see, that was the mistake. You don't ever wrap a fig in plastic because that does not allow the tree to breathe. The situation here, and this is common, a lot of people like to grow figs. It is one of the most popular topics
mm-hmm.
on the show. But north of a line roughly from D.C., Washington, D.C., heading west,
right.
the above-ground growth cannot survive winter. They're a Mediterranean plant. They're used to having four seasons, but the
right.
difference between the seasons is very subtle. They don't freeze in the winter, and they
mm-hmm.
become these giant, very woody trees. In our area, in New Jersey, Delaware, Pennsylvania, and especially as you move further up into New York State and, you know, into the Midwest, the figs simply need to be protected against the worst of winter cold. So what you're going to do right now is either you're going to go out or you're going to have somebody go out who's comfortable doing this, and you're going to prune away all the dead wood. What happens is you get new growth from the bottom, from the root system.
Right.
But this new growth starts too late in the season generally for you to get figs. Then this coming fall, I really recommend waiting until we've had a couple of light frosts. They're not really that sensitive. They just need to be protected against the worst of winter. But
mm-hmm.
after the tree has lost all its leaves and gone completely
mm-hmm.
dormant, then you can prune a little bit if you feel you must. But if there's
mm-hmm.
not a lot of biomass left, don't do any pruning in the fall. And
mm-hmm.
then the best way to protect these trees is to drive some stakes into the ground about a foot away from the center of the trunk and then wrap burlap around the stakes. You don't want to
mm-hmm.
wrap the tree itself, ideally. And that's really all you're going to need where you are. That'll cut
mm-hmm.
the winter wind, which is really the damaging part. And don't put anything over top because once it gets wet or snow
mm-hmm.
and then it freezes,
mm-hmm.
that can damage the plant. And then in the spring, as soon as you see the first green on any other plants, take the burlap away and watch
mm-hmm.
the fig tree. And when you start to see new growth appear, that's when you can do some pruning of the old dead wood. But just with that burlap in place and no plastic, you should have twice as much green next season.
Oh, wow.
And then early on in the season, say in May, that's the time to take cuttings and give them to all your friends and tell them to plant the cuttings close to the house and keep them watered until they get new green growth so that this tree will be replicated. But don't worry about it. It's not dead at all. It my sense is it's probably very healthy. It just had a tough winter, but the root system of these figs is just amazing. And if you want more information, go to the website. Go to youbetyourgarden.org. Click on the Garden Answers link at the top of the page and go to F for figs. And there's several discussions about wrapping for the winter.
Okay. Thank you so much. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure. You take care. Diane, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Hi.
Hello, Diane. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you.
And where is Diane very well?
Well, right now I'm in Maryland, but my home is in Philadelphia, and what I'm calling about is in Philadelphia.
Okay. What can we do for Diane in Overbrook?
Okay. About 25 years ago, I planted this Korean dogwood. It's absolutely beautiful, but it has this red fruit that comes out at the end of the summer, fall, and drops all over the lawn, the sidewalk, yada, yada. Anyway, my neighbors are up in arms about this fruit that falls, and I do try and sweep it up, but I would literally have to stand there with a broom to do it. Good job. There's so much fruit. So I was wondering if you had any, you know, either pruning advice, or is there something that you could feed the tree that would kind of cut down on the fruit?
Oh, goodness, no. And you wouldn't want to do that. Dogwoods are kind of sensitive trees. They're very prone to disease issues sometimes. They can be real drama queens. But the fact that yours is producing so much fruit shows that you have a happy or healthy tree. You would have to actually physically damage it to limit the fruit production. So one thing that's coming to mind, but I believe that fruit is edible.
Yes, it is. I looked it up.
And have you ever tried it?
No, I have not.
Because, you know, not only is it edible for humans, but it's a great food for birds. This is a very environmentally sound tree. Now, are your homes so close together that the fruit is falling actually on the neighbor's property?
Yes, yes. It's a row home situation, and I have tried pruning the branches that hang over, and neighbors would like them pruned even more, but I don't want a totally misshapen tree either.
Right. Okay. How tall is the tree?
I'm going to say two stories. So maybe what's that, 22 feet or something?
Yeah. Okay. So it's a big, honking, healthy tree. Yeah.
Yes. Yes.
Okay. So you would do your pruning or have somebody do the pruning in the dead of winter. You may have no choice other than to dramatically change the shape because you're kind of responsible for anything that, quote, damages their property in any way, shape, or form. But they could have no complaint if, again, there is no part of the tree that overhangs their property. And if you want to have a professional arborist, a real certified arborist, come out and look at it, they may be able to do the job and keep a good shape to it. The only way you can limit the fruit production is to prune the tree immediately after flowering. Now, with that much fruit, this sucker must be covered with flowers in the spring.
It is. It's beautiful. The flowers are almost gone now, but and the fruit is just starting to develop. They're really, really tiny, and they haven't turned red yet.
Okay. So if you were to have somebody who were really into it, all they would have to do is pull off the flowers at the end of their vital stage, and no fruits would form on those parts of the plant. But a good pruning over winter to dramatically reduce the shape, change the shape perhaps, but by an expert could be reshaped into something new, would at least get the neighbors out of the way. With a tree this healthy, I'm going to say that if you do it at the right time of year, which would be the dead of winter when nobody wants to, that's the right time, you can remove up to a third of the tree and not do any long-lasting harm.
If I just trim some of the branches now, would that be okay and then get it pruned really well in the winter?
This is a really stressful time to prune. I mean, we've had some days that have, like, kissed 100 in the area, and to cause an open wound this time of year could be devastating. Even worse would be the fall. The only safe time to prune big trees like this is in the dead of winter or very early spring.
Okay.
All right.
Thank you so much. I love your show.
Thank you so much. Good luck, Diane.
All right. Bye-bye.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will deliver Brown Bag and Monarch Moment lunchtime lectures at the famed Chautauqua Institute in upstate New York on Monday, July 30th and Tuesday, July 31st. But don't go looking for all the details at the events section of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with what can happen if you try and cross the pond with your plants, the curious case of Peerless Pruner, Dr. Lee Reich, and your curious phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. Coming up later in the show, how can you grow the same plant as a friend in another country? Can you take a cutting and bring it back home with you? We'll discuss all your international options. We'll also take a lot more of your fabulous phone calls. But now, as promised, it is time to welcome back one of our most special friends, Dr. Lee Reich, who has written many books, has many to his credit, including the pruning book, probably 1,800 books on growing fruits organically. And his latest book is called The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. Lee, welcome back as always to You Bet Your Garden.
Great to be back.
So this is a book of your musings, tips, thoughts about science. What's going on here?
Well, I was in my garden one day. I was making compost, and I was thinking how when I was making compost, I wasn't just tossing things randomly into my compost bins, that there was actually a little conscious and subconscious stuff going on. And I was thinking how I was really drawing on what I'd learned in graduate school in agriculture, what I'd learned from talking to other people, what I'd learned as a researcher for Cornell and the USDA, and my practical experience, you know, gardening for a long time. And all this was going to the mix. And so there was science really driving it. And I was thinking how, like, you know, there's obviously a lot of science that's going on in the garden. You don't have to know it, but if you do know it, it makes things a little better. And then I thought how this applied to so many other things in the garden, too. Like,
yeah, my garden is the middle ground between science and superstition. All right, so the book is divided into many sections. I'm just going to start at the beginning. I checked off a couple. Talk to us about roughing up your seedlings. Are you a bully? You pushing these poor little seedlings around, Mr. Tough Guy?
So as I stated in the book, if you spent like 2 years in a cave under, you know, sort of not very cold and not very hot conditions and relative darkness, and then all of a sudden you went out on a spring day where the sun's shining, you would be squinting at the very least. You'd probably sunburn really quickly, and you might feel a little chilled depending on what the temperature was. And basically when seedlings come out from indoors, they experience the same thing. They're just in shock if they come out from, you know, even a grow light, which really, amount of light, a grow light or a fluorescent light or even a sunny window pours on a seedling is nothing like full sun outdoors. So these seedlings, you have to harden them off. You have to toughen them up a little so that they can get used to being outside. You can't just put them outside in the garden. And there's changes that happen in the cell structure and within the cells to make them more adaptable. Basically, you do it sort of tough love. You gradually expose them to more variations in temperature. Start out and put them in dappled shade rather than full sun. Keep them sheltered from the wind. And then after a couple of weeks of that, they're tougher and they can take the outdoors. And one other thing I mentioned that I think is a cool thing is that if you just brush your, caress your seedlings every day.
It's a family show, Lee. A family show, man. Come on.
You can do it with a snow brush, like you brush off your windshield if you don't want to do it in a more intimate lead by hand. So if you just caress your seedlings every day, it sort of mimics the effect of wind, and that also helps make them shorter, stockier, and tougher.
When I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, I can remember one of the neatest little tips we gave people, because you mentioned sunny windowsill, and sunny windowsill, as you and I both know, is Latin for how to grow plants that look more like basketball players that are tall and skinny. And the tip was, back in these days, to take an index card and take your plants out from where they were and just gently brush the top of them with an index card. And there were studies that showed that it had kept them from getting too leggy, that it had improved their shortness and stockiness, which is what you want, especially in tomatoes.
And it's sort of logical. If you picture, say, a mountainside exposed to the wind and picture what the plants would be like there, trees and things like that, they're really short and stocky. You might say stunted, but they're short and stocky. Just the movement of the wind makes for a shorter, stockier growth. And this is the kind of growth you want, just to get the plant used to the great outdoors.
Yeah, nobody ever won a tomato contest by growing the tallest seedling.
Right.
Let's talk humus, or hummus. It's made from chickpeas, right? What the heck is humus?
Basically, humus has always been defined as the most recalcitrant or resistant to any sort of dissolution part of the soil. So it's always pictured, well, in the soil you have organic matter, which is things that are living and things that were living. These are carbon compounds. As part of this organic matter, you had part of it that just lasted forever in the soil because it was so resistant to decay, and this was known as humus. And then more recently, just before while I was working on the book, I had read this theory that humus is sort of a laboratory artifact. Like when you extract all the organic portion of the soil using various, solvents like sodium hydroxide, things like that, everything comes out, but one part just remains. And that's the part that they figured was so resistant to decay and was the permanent part of organic matter in the soil. And we'll call that humus. Two scientists came up with this theory, which I am totally embracing, that really doesn't exist in nature. It's just something when you do this extraction, and that basically all the organic matter in the soil is in this constant state of flux. It's more than academic. It really figures into gardening because, organic matter is good for the soil. It's good to enrich the soil with compost, leaves, things like that. But it's not something you just do once and you did it, so now you forget about it. It's constantly in flux. It's constantly breaking down, forming new compounds, feeding microorganisms, decomposing, reforming, and disappearing to some degree. So you always have to keep adding it. You keep adding it. You keep feeding the soil organic matter, which really is the basis for organic gardening. It's what put the word organic in organic gardening.
One thing I've often found is that gardeners become fixated by nitrogen levels. They'll get a soil test, and the soil test will report the levels of nitrogen, and they'll go, oh, I'm low or I'm high. And I go, no, that changed an hour after the test. That's ridiculous. They shouldn't even be testing it. I said, what you want to know is your levels of organic matter. Percentage of organic matter shows you how alive your garden is.
Geez, I hate to say it, but I 100% agree.
Yeah, well, even a broken watch is right twice a day, Lee.
That's 100% true, because there is no good test for soil nitrogen, because as you said, it's always changing. And basically, if you have your soil constantly enriched with organic matter, basically you'll have everything your soil needs.
Yeah. All right, so I want to move on to a topic that is very plant-specific. And this is something I really didn't encounter at Organic Gardening. After I left Organic Gardening and started this show, I saw it in the wild. And I've had it explained to me, but I'm still confused by the witch's broom. Is it a parasite? Is it an alien being? Is it what?
Well, witch's broom is the type of growth that instead of plant, a stem growing along, and then you have like nice side branches every few inches coming off it. Everything happens right at one spot, so it makes this very concentrated section where you have all these branches coming off together. So it looks like a broom. So hence it's called Witch's Broom. Occasionally you might look up into a tree and you'll see, instead of the usual branching, all of a sudden you see this area of tight branching. So that's where there's a Witch's Broom. And the cause is a change in the hormones within the plant. But the thing that causes that can be any one of a number of things. It could be a transmutation. It could be, I don't want to say disease, it could be a fungus, because it doesn't kill the plant, doesn't necessarily even harm the plant. It just changes the growth habit. So it could be just something that changes, you know, insect and fungus. You know, I always like to talk about the practical implications of all these things. And the practical implications of that is a witch's broom is a nice, tight growth habit. And if you can get a hold of that witch's broom and propagate it, you can have a shrub or, say, a tree, instead of it being 40 feet tall, maybe it'll only grow to be 4 feet tall, and it'll have this very dense growth. And if you ever see some of these dwarf spruce trees, these nice tight cones that hardly grow at all every year. So basically that was started by somebody saw a witch's broom up in a tree, got some branches from it, propagated it, and then make a whole bunch of plants that look just like the witch's broom, except they're not on top of a tree. They're starting at ground level.
So you see this almost as an opportunity instead of a eyesore.
Oh, yeah, it's definitely an opportunity. I guess the one downside, as I point out in the book, is that they're often high up in trees. And the way people frequently have gotten them down is they get somebody who's really good with a 22 and they shoot them down.
Vegetarian hunting, it's the new thing, Lee. All right, we have been talking to Dr. Lee Reich, whose new book is The Ever Curious Gardener, Using a Little Natural Science for a Much Better Garden. It is out new from New Society Publishers. Lee, welcome back, and don't be a stranger, okay?
Thanks.
And now back to your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Bob, welcome to You Bet Your Garden. Where are you, sir?
In my kitchen in Ardmore, Pennsylvania.
Okay, just outside of Philadelphia. A delightful suburb, in fact.
Yes, it is.
All right. What can we do for Bob in Ardmore, PA?
We're committed to organic gardening, and we're actually looking into, in addition to that, converting our garden into raised beds. And part of that is aesthetic, but a lot of it also has to do with weed control.
Absolutely.
And we will be starting this summer. We won't complete it this summer. And in the meantime, I was over in a garden store here in Delaware County, and they recommended a product that might help us with weed control. And it was part of the discussion that I was having with them regarding getting organic mulch that they have from a wonderful company called Mechanic. And they suggested Typar landscape fabric. I looked at it and said, well, it looks like it's plastic or nylon or something. And they said yes, and the beauty of it is the organic ingredients and water trickle through, and it, you know, the fabric retards the growth of weeds. And I thought about it and went home and started looking at it online. And
so you didn't buy any?
Well, I did, but I went back today and turned it in.
Right, because you realize this stuff is amazing. It is weed fabric. It's not weed control. Mm-hmm. It's fabric that allows your weeds to grow unmolested and in a manner in which you could never control them. Because you put this plastic material down on the ground, but of course the soil has to breathe and rainwater and irrigation water has to get through. Right. So it's pockmarked with all these tiny little holes. Mm-hmm. Well, as you know, as a gardener, the biggest weed problems aren't dandelions or anything like that. It's grassy weeds, especially if you till. You bring all these grassy weed seeds to the surface and they germinate. And it is just perfect for the little blades of grass, the baby blades, to get up through these holes and get up into the bright sunshine. And then their root system makes a beautiful mat, completely covering the underground part of the plastic. So after about 6 months, you can't get the grass out and you can't get the plastic up. It's like it's nailed to the floor 100,000 times.
Well, we decided not to use it anyway because they told us that none of the fabric would bleed or bleach into the soil, but I got online and it looks like it does, so we just returned it.
Yeah, the less plastic you have to use in the garden, the better. I still will always use plastic six-packs to sprout my seeds and grow my tomatoes and peppers, but as I've been using the same ones for 15 years, I think I've lowered the carbon footprint on those. Right. Well, you know, one thing that has been lost over time is the art of the hoe. You know, you go into a garden center, you say, I got weeds, and they sell you a weed killer. And really, these chemicals are some of the most treacherous on the planet, and they've only been around for 50, 60 years, whereby the standard hoe, the grape hoe, goes back untold centuries, millennia. You can go into a good garden center or on a good online catalog, and you can get what's called a diamond hoe, which has a rectangular small blade that's super sharp, like an old single-edge razor blade. And you can just move that very gently and decapitate any weed you have. And it's easy to use. It doesn't put anything in the soil. You get a tiny bit of exercise, but not a lot. And then there's another hoe I like called the winged weeder. And this is also super sharp, but it is a triangle shape as opposed to a flat blade. And the winged weeder junior, the head is ridiculously small. It's only about the size of a quarter. So you can get right up next to a plant and you can slice off the weeds with very little risk of even nicking the plant. And in this interim time, while you're still building your raised beds, that's the best way to control weeds in a flat earth garden. You hoe them away, and then, yes, it sounds like your organic mulch is compost. So,
Yeah, it sure is. It's hardwood bark that they say is organic, and it's mixed with compost.
Okay, don't use that then, because the hardwood bark is going to absorb nitrogen during its first year on the soil. There's no reason to mix any kind of bark into compost. Studies that were conducted across three universities back in the 90s clearly showed that 2 inches of compost alone suppresses weeds just as well or better than 2 inches of shredded hardwood mulch.
Very good. I didn't know that.
Yeah,
that's
just
a wonderful suggestion.
Just straight compost. It feeds your plants. Every time it rains, they get a dose of compost tea on the roots, prevents weeds, brightens your teeth. It's great.
Okay, good. Now, related to the raised beds, we just put on the very bottom cardboard?
Yes, I recommend that for the first year, especially if the area was a lawn or weed infested. And then you make the frames at least a foot high, and you fill them with compost and some perlite for drainage. And then over the course of that first season, the cardboard's going to rot away. But in the meantime, it'll smother any weeds that might try to come up.
Okay. You have been extremely helpful, and we greatly appreciate it.
All right. Well, thank you, sir. Have a good season.
Thank you, too.
Well, it's time for me to take a little break and announce that I will, one, speak at the American Birding Expo in Oaks, PA on Saturday, September 22nd, and in beautiful Pinehurst, North Carolina on Tuesday, October 23rd. And two, yell at you if you haven't harvested your garlic yet. But don't go checking the Mike's Events and A to Z Answers sections of our website just yet, because we'll be right back with what can happen if you try and cross the pond with your plants and more of your fabulous phone calls. I'm Mike McGrath, and you're listening to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia.
Support for You Bet Your Garden is provided by the Espoma Company, offering a complete selection of natural organic plant foods and potting soils. More information about Espoma and the Espoma Natural Gardening Community can be found at espoma.com.
Welcome back to You Bet Your Garden from WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. And we're in the stretch now, cats and kittens. In just a little bit, we'll get to the question of the week. A listener here in the States wants to share parts of the same plant with a colleague in Germany. How can he do this? Can he take cuttings and bring them home? We'll discuss what his options are after a couple more of your fabulous phone calls at 1-888-346-9499. Christine, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
Thank you.
And where is Christine Good?
I live in what they call the Castor Gardens section of Philadelphia.
In the Northeast, like Castor and Common.
Okay, Castor Avenue in the Northeast.
Yeah.
Okay, very good. I know that area well. What can we do for Christine in the great Northeast?
Okay, so I guess I'm an urban gardener, and I have a pest problem that is pretty unique to the urban gardener, and that is roaches. I believe that's what they are. Growing up, they've always been called water bugs. They're something that comes out every summer. They crawl all over the sidewalk. Anybody from Philly knows that. And they're in my garden. And I really wasn't expecting this. And I don't know how to get rid of them.
I grew up in Philly. I remember the, quote, water bugs you talk about. And they are no kind of a roach. Roaches are actually fairly small creatures.
They're not.
No, true roaches.
True roaches. I mean, they're not roaches?
No, they're not roaches. The German cockroach is about one-third the size and is really an indoor pest. I don't think I've ever seen an actual cockroach outdoors. They love to live inside human homes, and contrary to popular opinion, they don't have anything to do with the home being dirty. Generally, there's leaking water underneath a sink or in a crawl space somewhere, and they are creatures of high humidity. But no,
right.
outdoors, and I presume you're talking about fairly large, black-colored beetles.
Yeah, they're giant, mm-hmm. Yes.
But you haven't noticed them eating anything in your garden, have you?
No, I haven't. And that's one of the things is that it's not really so much of a pest as it is just gross.
Okay, so maybe I can change your impression. Because I believe what you have patrolling and protecting your garden are what are called, in general terms, ground beetles, especially the rove, R-O-V-E, beetle. These are predators of slugs, snails, all sorts of caterpillars.
All the bad things.
Yes, exactly. Any kind of insect pest that lives close to the surface of the soil. Ground beetles, and I'm glad you called because I can't remember the last time we discussed ground beetles, but they are one of the great predators and totally beneficial insects that can be found in a garden. They eat no plant material, and I would have wagered that rather than seed damage on your plants look really good.
Yeah, they do, except for what the squirrels are doing. They actually do.
Yeah, the squirrels are evil. That's a whole different topic. But these beetles are tremendously beneficial, especially because you've had a very wet season. You know, there have been little bit times of dryness, but it was a very wet and cool spring, and that's the ideal situation to breed lots of slugs. That's the biggest enemy in a season like this, and that's the preferred meal of ground beetles. They do not eat any plants at all. They only eat insect pests. And when I was the editor of Organic Gardening magazine, we used to run a lot of articles on how to attract them to the garden. If you can get over any negative ideas and look at them as like they were praying mantises or ladybugs or something else that's fighting for you when you're not in the garden, they are tremendously beneficial. Again, especially in a year like this where generally slug problems are getting out of control right now.
Right.
So,
yeah,
and
I mean,
if
I
you
did
want to
notice that, yeah, that my garden was especially healthy. Like, yep. All my tomatoes look good, even the rose bush.
Yeah. The truth is, the more life you have in the garden, the happier the garden's going to be. And the more life in your garden, the livelier the garden's going to be.
Okay. Well,
bye-bye. Evan, welcome to You Bet Your Garden.
How's it going?
I am hanging in there, Ev. How are you?
I'm all right.
And where is Evan Allwright?
Philadelphia.
So specifically?
Northwest, Roxborough.
Yeah, what can we do for you, Ev?
So I have an ash tree in my front yard.
I'm sorry.
And it's not looking good.
Yeah. Have you had it diagnosed?
Not officially, but there's not many leaves left. Maybe about 20% of the leaves are left.
Mm-hmm.
They're kind of small leaves, and there's little holes all over the tree.
Oh,
I'm just
man.
Wondering. It looks like, from my research, it looks like we're going to have to cut it down. but I was just wondering if you had any other options we could go with.
No, not this late in the game. The emerald ash borer, an imported pest, is destroying the trees whose wood makes the best baseball bats. If you watch Major League Baseball, over the years you see more broken bats all the time. And that's because the supply of ash wood has become precarious low, and they're making them out of maple. They're too brittle, and they break, and it's really dangerous. But, I mean, this is like Dutch elm disease or the chestnut blight. We are seeing a major component of our woodlands and our home-based trees being devastated. They may well go extinct.
Yeah, it's really a shame. That particular tree has a lot of sentimental value to my family, but it looks like we're going to have to get it cut.
Yeah, there's very little you can do. How tall is it?
I'm bad at estimating, but it's taller than the house.
Yeah, see, because this is an expensive proposition. They have to come in with a crane and, you know, disassemble the tree piece by piece. It's going to cost thousands of dollars.
Is it going to fall eventually?
Yes.
Okay.
And more importantly, they're breeding in there. Those holes you see are the entrance holes to the galleries where they're raising their young. So if it doesn't get cut down and the wood destroyed, you become a breeding ground for more emerald ash borers. So it's unfortunate, but it's really the only responsible thing you can do. Now, I'm going to cut to the chase. I mean, there's no good answer for you here. But you have two options when you get down to the bone here. No matter what, the most major part of the tree has to come down. And that's going to be expensive, and you're going to have them destroy the wood. After that, when they get down to the bottom, if there's no infestation at the trunk, you can save a lot of money and damage by leaving a certain amount of the trunk in place. Now, you want a certified arborist company to come out and take down the tree, so they're going to see where the infestation is. But it would be double the expense to have the stump actually removed. And there could be water lines and stuff down there, which would cause a lot of damage. Now, they'll tell you that they'll grind the stump down to soil level. But that's really not that helpful to you because you still have this giant plug in the ground. So what I suggest instead is to leave 6 inches to a foot of the stump in place and then box that out and use that area as a raised bed. And growing in that area and watering and feeding the plants will also accelerate the final rotting of the underground stump and root systems.
Sounds like it's going to have to come down.
Oh, it must. I'm sorry. I'm trying to think. You can contact the state. Maybe go through Penn State because they're the, you know, center of the extension system in Pennsylvania. There may be some financial help for you. I know there are vast programs to try to control and eliminate this insect. You got nothing to lose, but the State Department of Agriculture or the extension system, they can certainly offer you advice. And there may be some financial help for you, but yeah, it has to come down.
Okay, well, thanks for the advice.
Okay, I'm sorry, man.
It's all good.
Okay, good luck, Ev.
Thanks, have a good one.
All right, as promised, it's time for the question of the week. Crossing the pond with the intent to commit horticulture. Brett Rader, Associate Producer of Production Association here at You Bet Your Garden. Please get us started by reading this week's intriguing and international question.
Sure, Mike. Chad in New Hanover Township, just north of Pottstown, PA, writes, I teach high school German and Spanish and run a reciprocal short-term group exchange program with a teacher in Munich, Bavaria. Chad explains that Bavaria is to Germany like Texas is to the U.S. He says, because of my affinity for hydrangeas, I came up with an idea I hope you will find interesting enough to help with. When I'm in Munich, the capital of Bavaria, later this July, I want to give my foreign exchange counterpart, Veit, and his new wife, Effie, a hydrangea, specifically Hydrangea macrophylla Bavaria, and take cuttings from it home with me so that after the cuttings take root, we will effectively be sharing the same hydrangea plant across two continents. The root of the problem, pun intended, is that Google as I may, I can't seem to find out who to ask about bringing those cuttings home. as I believe it is highly frowned upon to bring plants into the U.S. without going through the proper channels. If you could help me, I would be ever so grateful. Dankeschön. If you think the cuttings might not be viable after transatlantic flights, I could probably just buy two identical plants, which might be clones anyway. Now, Mike, this is interesting, but does the topic appeal to enough people to get its own question of the week?
Oh, yes, indeedy. In fact, variations on this theme are one of the most frequent questions we get. People are always asking things like, I brought home a pack of seeds I bought in a garden center in England or France. Did I break the law? Technically, yes. But the risk of injuring the environment with professionally packaged seed from a developed country is low to nil. More troublesome would be seed from somebody's garden, as it would not have been inspected for common diseases and such. Next worst would be the cuttings Chad mentions, as they could also harbor the eggs or larvae of insect pests. The absolute worst would be potted plants, as their soil could contain billions of bad actors. But I didn't want to just base my answer on my own feelings and some research. So I turned to a good friend who travels the world looking for unique ideas for upcoming editions of the Philadelphia Flower Show, the show's designer, Sam Lemhenny.
And Sam responds, Chad is correct. Customs does not like people bringing in plants from other countries. Usually soil is the biggest reason, as the potential for soil-borne pests is high. Cuttings are less dangerous and more interesting. I have heard of folks sneaking them into the U.S. and not getting caught. They used strong, sealed plastic bags with wet paper towels to keep the humidity high around the cuttings, but I would never advocate such a thing. Sam continues, however, if you do go through the proper channels, which would involve U.S. Customs and the Department of Agriculture, the cuttings might not be viable after inspection delays. The easiest answer is to select a variety that can be sourced in both countries and take government out of the situation. I try and stay far away from importing plants for the Philly Flower Show because of the unknowns and the very specific deadlines we have for the show.
All right. Thank you, Sam. I'll see you at the 2019 show this coming March.
Okay. But how can you determine if a plant is available in Bavaria?
I tell you, man, the internet got me darn close. A nursery in England, specifically in Kent, called Signature Hydrangeas, carries this specific variety. I first was thinking that the European Union would make shipping to Germany easy, but then I saw that the price was in pounds sterling instead of euros, and I was reminded of Brexit. So Chad or his friend will have to shoot the nursery an email and ask about shipping to Germany.
And if the answer is no?
There's every reason to believe that a cultivar named Bavaria is going to be available in the hometown of BMW and Oktoberfest. After that, there's the other states that make up the Republic of Germany. And Bavaria shares a completely open border with Austria, Switzerland, and the Czech Republic. I don't think it's going to be difficult to source the exact same plant over there. Well, those sure was some interesting ideas about how to grow the same plants as people in dramatically different time zones. Now, wasn't they? Luckily for you, the question of the week appears in print at the Gardens Alive website. To read it over at your leisure or leisure, whichever you have, just click the link for the question of the week at our website, youbetyourgarden.org. Gardens Alive supports the You Bet Your Garden question of the week, and you will always find the latest question of the week at the Gardens Alive website. Yikes, my producer is threatening to send me through customs if I don't get out of this studio. We must be out of time. But you can call us anytime at 1-888-346-9499 or send us your email, your tired, your poor, your wretched refuse teeming towards our garden shore at garden@whyy.org. Please include your location. And visit our website, youbetyourgarden.org, where you'll find the answers to all your garden questions, audio of this show, past shows, and our podcast. Ken Queter plays our theme song. Our vice president of production is Terry Murray. Elizabeth Perez Luna is executive producer of audio content for WHYY. Our engineer is Al Banks, and our social media director is Amanda McGrath. Check out her fine work and stay current with the show at the You Bet Your Garden Facebook page. Larissa Sapko and Rich Banowitz keep our webbing worldwide. International man of mystery, Al Banks, is our editor. Our ambassadorial associate producer of Production Association is Brett Rader. I'm your host, Mike McGrath. You know, I almost got popped in Belgium once, and it did not involve any kind of plant. Remember that guy who grabbed a red-hot medallion in the first Indiana Jones movie? Well, here I am in the train station, and he comes up to me, black fedora, black raincoat, same glasses. I did not see the palm of one of his hands. And he wants to see my papers. Let's just say that maybe I was in the country kind of accidentally at the time, and he did not want me to see you again next week.